Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode. This week I'm going to be comparing the original 1951 film Day the Earth Stood Still with its 2008 remake. So let's jump right into some background material on both of these films. The original film was based on a short story published in 1940 called Farewell to the Master by Harry Bates. This producer, Julian Blaustein, at one point set out to make a film to illustrate sort of what was going on in the world at that time, which was characterized by, you know, the Cold War, atomic age, late 40s, early 50s. We were right in just after the two atom bombs were used in Japan. I believe the Soviets got the bomb pretty quickly afterwards. So this producer read tons and tons and tons of science fiction short stories, wanting to do, you know, the atomic age sort of again as a metaphor, which is why I love sci-fi so much, because it can be used metaphorically. Decided to use Harry Bates' short story and hired a guy named Edmund North to write the screenplay. And the studio head at this time, Darryl F. Zanuck, gave the go-ahead for the project. Final revised screenplay was completed on February 21st, 1951, and sci-fi writer Raymond F. Jones worked also as an uncredited advisor. The sets were designed by Thomas Little and Claude Carpenter. They collaborated with architect Frank Lloyd Wright for the design of the spacecraft. A gentleman named Paul Laffoley has suggested that the futuristic interior was inspired by Wright's Johnson Wax headquarters, which he completed in 1936. Some background on the remake. 20th Century Fox had produced a successful Keanu Reeves film, Speed, in 1994. When someone at the studio saw a poster for the 1951 film, Day of the Earth Stood Still, I believe it was a Fox product, made this gentleman ponder a remake with star Keanu as Klaatu. And by the time writer David Scarpa started writing a draft of the script in 2005, 11 years later, a gentleman named Thomas Rothman was in charge of Fox and felt a responsibility to remake the film. The writer, Scarpa, felt everything about the original was still relevant, but changed the allegory from nuclear war to environmental damage because, quote, the specifics of how we now have the capability to destroy ourselves have changed, end quote. Writer Scarpa noted the recent events of Hurricane Katrina in 2005 informed his mindset when writing the screenplay. I think some of the footage of some Katrina rescues are in this film from time to time as well. Scarpa scrapped Klaatu's speech at the conclusion of the story in the original because he felt, quote, audiences today are unwilling to tolerate that. People don't want to be preached to about the environment. We tried to avoid having our alien looking out over the garbage in the lake and crying a silent tear. From the 1970s, Keep America Beautiful ads with the Indian, end quote. Director Scott Derrickson, who was hired to do the remake, admired the original film's director Robert Wise, whom he met as a film student. Derrickson's benchmark also was Philip Kaufman's 1978 remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Klaatu is made more menacing than in the original because the director felt he had to symbolize the more complex era of the 2000s. There was a debate over whether to have Klaatu land in Washington, D.C., as in the original, but Derrickson chose New York City because he liked something about the geometry of the sphere landing in Central Park. Astronomer Seth Shostak served as a scientific consultant on the film, reviewed the script several times for errors, and gave suggestions for making the scientists appear less dry, and noted that they would refer to one another on a first-name basis, among other additions and suggestions to the script. So that's a background on the remake. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to compare these two films to each other in three chunks. The first chunk is going to be the beginning of the film up to when Klaatu escapes captivity. Then The next chunk of the film will be from that moment to when the Klaatu meets Dr. Barnhart, which he does in both films. And then the last chunk will be from Barnhart till the end of the film. And I'll compare each chunk with each other, talk about what I think the original does and what the remake does and what I think one's doing better or worse than the other. I'll also talk a little bit about and compare the casts and the characters somewhat as I go as well. So let's jump right in, and we'll start with the original film. And before I start, I'll talk a little bit about the original film's director, who is, you know, one of the giants of 20th century American film. Robert Wise is his name. He's an American film director, producer, and editor. He won the Academy Awards for Best Director and Best Picture for both West Side Story and The Sound of Music. He was also nominated for Best Film Editing for Citizen Kane, so this guy's been around for a while. Other films he directed were The Sand Pebbles with Steve McQueen, The Body Snatcher, 1945, I think unrelated to the two Body Snatcher films. Born to Kill, The Setup, The Day the Earth Stood Still, Destination Gobi, This Could Be the Night, Run Silent, Run Deep, Andromeda Strain, 71, and Star Trek The Motion Picture, of all things. With that, we jump in. And just so you note, in 1951, most films were still in a 4:3 aspect ratio, so which is basically your old TV box rather than the widescreen formats that even TVs are using now today. We don't really do the box anymore anywhere. If you've gotten a widescreen version of the original 1951 film, you've gotten a cut-up film, please send it back with a letter, an angry letter attached. It is a 4:3 aspect ratio. Over our opening credits, we get an eerie sort of 50s, you know, a lot of the science fiction movies back in the 50s and the creature features were, you know, had this weird like theremin type melody. If you know, a theremin is this this instrument where it depends on where you put your hands in approximation to it magnetically. I think it senses where your hands are and makes these weird sounds based on it. So theremins were used from time to time in 50s, and you'll know it if you hear it. I believe Bernard Herrmann also did the score for the original film, who was a big Alfred Hitchcock guy and scored, you know, just dozens and dozens, if not, you know, hundreds of films in the 60s and 50s. This film opens what I like to call 100 miles up. It's very hip today. And modern filmmaking, we always open with character and we build into the larger thing that's going on. But back in the 50s, the classic sci-fi movies, they opened with the big picture. So we open at a military radar station and we immediately see they're tracking something moving extremely fast. We then cut to the Brits picking it up over in Hong Kong, then to India and Calcutta, where we see them, then France. So we're sort of all of these international stations are tracking this object as it's moving towards the U.S. and has been circling the Earth. So we get a big montage of a lot of people sitting around radios and all kinds of public spaces, news guys talking on these radios. No one knows what the object is. It's a classic 50s sci-fi, right? It finally gets to D.C. We get a lot of wonderful shots of D.C., really beautifully framed. The movie is very classically shot. We track it then across the Capitol sky, this glowing flattened disc, which is not a little bad. They don't go so close up, so it's not too bad for the times, I have to say. Very simple. And it sets down in a park among some baseball fields, this gold disc, about as a classic a flying saucer shape as you're going to get for the 50s. Then the next beat is the response of the humans. And so we see all these cop cars and military machines all coming out and, you know, roaring down the street, and all the military units are gearing up and everything's getting ready. Newspaper reels, men calling the president, you know, very what I call like 100 miles up, top-down approach to open the movie, which is interesting. Then great suspense. We're in the park and all these crowds are surrounding the ship. Ramp emerges smoothly from the ship. Still looks great today, I think. And a doorway opens at the top and a human figure emerges, helmeted in what we would call today like a radiation suit. Like, you know, it's incredibly dated, but it's still well done for its time. And immediately, without any kind of obfuscation, we hear what the character who will become known as Klaatu say, quote, "We have come to visit you in peace and with goodwill." And he slowly walks out down the ramp. And now we're closing up faces on a lot of the regular people in the crowd, and we're getting reactions. Some people are anxious, some people are afraid. I was happy to see a good smattering of people of color in this crowd. I thought 1951, you know, American genre film, how cool, you know, like some diversity in the crowd. So that was kind of an interesting thing this time around. So as Klaatu comes down, all the soldiers raise their weapons, right? They don't know what his deal is. And when he reaches into his jumpsuit, he pulls out some device that, you know, could be basically the hilt of a lightsaber, right? Or an oversized flashlight. And when he comes closer to the crowd, he flicks the device, which a little dish pops out. And one of the soldiers, of course, surrounding him, panics and fires, hits Klaatu in the shoulder, and destroys the device. So Klaatu down. Now we see the second figure emerge from the craft, much larger, somewhat more menacing. It's very robotic looking, not at all like the figure we just saw, who was a kind of humanoid in a spacesuit. Now this is this gold creature kind of walks out. Now people begin to panic and run. And we close up on Gort, who will be named later, the robot. His visor opens up to reveal a singular eye, very Cylonic, as it were. And it begins to neutralize all of the weapons in the surrounding area with this heat ray. So it basically, the guns that the soldiers have in their hands disappear, completely disintegrates a tank, these big siege guns, and it's continuing to do it. And then the figure that's down on the floor rises and says something in a language we don't understand. And in that moment, Gort stops, the visor drops, and it sort of stands still. It's great. There's no dialogue during this initial confrontation. It's just a gunshot, figure falls, and then Gort comes out and does his thing. So it's really neat. The figure that got shot, I'll just use his real name, which is Klaatu. One of the military leaders comes over and says the device that you destroyed would have allowed them to study life on other worlds, and you know that is now destroyed, and that's not to be. So maybe think of a Twilight Zone episode when an alien gets killed and burned by these villagers, and we see at the very end a piece of paper burning saying the following is a cure for all forms of cancer. It's kind of, I'm sure the Twilight Zone episode came first. Klaatu's taken to the hospital. We go right to the hospital. He's sitting up in bed with bandages. It's this actor, Michael Rennie, who's a really cool, I don't think I've seen him or know him really from anything else except this movie. Very tall, very angular-looking man, really distinctive face, very intelligent-looking, extremely intelligent-looking, very broad-shouldered. So we get a gentleman named Mr. Harley, a very stout 50s-looking fellow, who's a secretary to the president, visiting Klaatu in the hospital, apologizing for the soldiers, and he asks Klaatu where he's from. Klaatu replies 250 million miles away on another planet that we are neighbors. And Harley asks him why he's here, and he immediately, you know, we start to get a bit of the mystery. He's not going to talk to the president. He says what he is here to say is for the entire planet, not just for one nation or one group. I love the conversation between the secretary and Klaatu. The secretary is quite an intelligent man, explains to Klaatu briefly about the current political situation, which at the time was, you know, the Red Scare, man, the Red Menace. So he's saying that, you know, Klaatu wants a UN meeting, and Harley's saying, you don't understand what this world is like, and it's going to be extremely difficult to get these nations to come together. And he in a sense, says that, you know, don't judge us too much. This is kind of who we are. You know, hopefully we will do better someday, but right now. And I just find that so wise. It, rather than what the remake does is using, you know, giving us a very kind of unintelligent, someone hardliner who's just there, who's going to like beat the crap out and torture this guy to get what they want. They make it an intelligent conversation between two people and like kind of allowing the audience in on an incredible rationality here. You know, it's back in the day when they weren't juicing screenplays up for like every moment of the screenplay has to be dripping with tension and drama. You know, you got to jack everything up to, because we're also desensitized to, you know, normal storytelling. Everything has to be so operatic now that they just have these, they can have these two people talk in this place where, you know, Harley's basically is in this place in society where he's like, look, I hear you, man, but we're a mess down here, you know, and he's not antagonistic, like, we'll get to the bottom of what you know, Mr. Klaatu, you know, I'll see to it, which is kind of what the remake does. So I really like that, and I like a little more what's to come when basically, Klaatu says, well, would you please make the request? And Harley's like, okay, you know, I don't like it, but I'll go and do what you ask, which is kind of nice. Klaatu does state that the future of the planet is at stake and to sort of make that claim to the other nations of the Earth. Two problems in any kind of film like this. Number one, why does he speak English? Number two, why is he a person, right? The remake deals with the second one pretty matter-of-factly, and the first one then becomes kind of a given. The original film here deals with the language in that they've been monitoring the broadcasts of the planet for years. So, you know, he can speak any language. There's really no explanation as to why he's a humanoid, why he's a human being, because they find out later that he's pound for pound, he's a human being. So, you know, that's just kind of left, I guess, to the imagination. I like the setup. It's very honest, and we don't really know what Klaatu wants other than it's a very dire emergency, but he won't say it. So, you know, immediately you've got a mystery that's pushing the film forward in a very honest way. Now, back at the flying saucer that he came in, we get Gort's story. Basically, teams are trying to move Gort and get into the ship, and we see all these workmen drilling, telling their bosses, I've drilled it with a diamond drill, no result, you know. Gort is immovable as well, and they find out the material that the saucer and Gort are both made out of is completely unknown and completely impenetrable. At some point, they take a salve from him, from Klaatu, back at the hospital that he used to heal himself from the gunshot wound. They're going to do some tests on it. And at this point, Mr. Harley returns, and again, very kind of wisely says, would you like to read some of the replies from your request? And we hear the absurd, we'll have the meeting in Moscow, but we're not going to meet here. And if so-and-so thinks we're going to meet here, we're not going to meet there. All these childish demands for where this meeting is going to take place, you know. Not going to be on American soil, but, you know, the Russians won't come here and, you know, the Poles won't go there. What I like here is great is that Harley immediately agrees with Klaatu. He's like, look, you know, we're a petty, fearful, and ignorant race, but don't judge us too harshly. And again, I just love that. I love that matter-of-fact knowingness, which means you have to work a little harder to make the story interesting because you're not milking this for what I call soap opera drama, which is, you know, Harley's going to be conniving and browbeating, so we'll be afraid for Klaatu, you know, which is kind of what the remake trucks in. It's a sad enough state of affairs, and it's just the film is allowed to deliver a very knowing and very real human thing within this movie, you know? So it's subtle, but again, it's this film so does not pander to its audience in any way that I can see. And each time I see evidence of it, I really like it. Then there is a bit of pushback. Klaatu wants to move among the populace to understand why it's impossible for them to kind of come together as a nation. You know, Harley is very veiled, but very honest here. He's like, I'm sorry, that's not going to be possible. So there is a pushback. There is a notion that, you know, he's a wise and kind of intelligent guy, but at the same time, he's like, yeah, you're kind of prisoner of the U.S., and so there is a veiled threat behind that, which is plenty. You know, that's enough. And this is great. They don't do anything. They come into Klaatu's room. He's just gone. And then we do another montage. Lots of montages in this film. We see the military mobilizing. There's lots of, you know, montage shots of all the activity of, you know, we think he's on this street and, you know, but get an APB out and newscasters and politicians. And I like that they don't show us how he got out. You know, they don't need to. It's, you know, part of the mystery is he's a dude from space. He's got a lot of powers and technology, and this is one of them, you know. So, okay, so I'm going to pause here, and then we're going to shift into remake mode. And we're going to follow the remake film to the same place in the story. And just a brief aside, the remake was directed by a gentleman named Scott Derrickson, who, among other films, has directed The Exorcism of Emily Rose, Day the Earth Stood Still, and then after Day the Earth Stood Still, he directed Sinister, Sinister 2, and he recently directed Doctor Strange, which came out about a month ago. He's sort of a journeyman genre director. Nothing really notable about his style. I don't find him particularly noteworthy in the things that I've seen. But anyway, just a little FYI, who's directing it. The remake opens in the past. We open in like 1928, the Karakoram Mountains in India. And what the remake will do, and what I will continue to point out, is that the remake will take the event of the aliens even arriving and milk so much drama out of it. Some of it rightly so. Like, it's kind of block, chock-a-block the original that it just kind of throws down. Like, aliens are here. He wants something. Let's go. You know, whereas the remake will truck in modern movie making and really, really drag it out. So we start even before the present time that the movie takes place. We're inside this tent. This solitary climber is sort of tenting for the night. And it's Keanu Reeves playing, you know, whoever this character is. He hears something outside, makes a climb with his ice axe towards the sound that I guess that he hears as we're getting the credits, comes into contact with a translucent sphere nearly 10 feet in diameter. Beautiful production design on the sphere. They look like liquid marbles, you know, it's the only thing I can think of. And we see the climber pick away at the sphere, and ice is formed around it, and it kind of chunks off. And on the other side of it is this sort of swirling mass, this flowing substance inside. And then we go to white, screen. And then when we cut back, the climber's on the ground, the sphere is gone. The climber has sort of a spherical scar tissue on his hand, which later we'll come to find out is the aliens taking a DNA sample, to produce being of their own upon, you know, when it's needed in the future. So that's new, this whole thing, which, you know, it's purely for effect, just building up the tension and the effect of before the reveal, which they do a lot in this film. It doesn't lend a damn thing to whether the movie's a solid movie at the end of the day. It's just kind of smoke and mirrors. So now we cut to present day, Princeton University. We meet Helen Benson, same name as who we will come to meet in the original, played by actress Jennifer Connelly. She's an astrobiologist of some kind. We see her teaching a class briefly, you know, sounds, there's a bit of the class going on, sounds pretty authentic. I'm sure they bounced it off of some real scientists and some real teachers. And we get a little bit of domestic action with her and her son, who's Will Smith's son, Jaden Smith, I believe is his name. She is a single mom. Jaden Smith is her stepson. The dad is somehow gone. We don't know how yet. There's a little moment of in his room, we see the dad's shaving brush that the son has found and claimed. So, you know, a little bit of daddy's gone. Nobody knows why. So then we have the big, you know, moment where all the government agents arrive at her house. This is very Andromeda Strain, I thought, this next sequence. And Robert Wise also directed Andromeda Strain. This director is a big fan of Robert Wise. So I got a sense that he took a little bit from the other Wise sci-fi movie. So she leaves the son with a neighbor and they're off. And it's pretty solid so far. No real missteps, you know. The scene between the mother and son was like, there's nothing in it that would pull, that would matter later on. So they didn't really use the scene to generate anything. It's just, they just presented a relationship and moved on, which you're like, okay. So it's fine. No real missteps yet. Connelly, usually very good in anything that she does, is fine here. Jaden Smith will deteriorate and become worse and worse the more lines he gets. He's just not a very good actor. In this, I don't know if he's grown into anything new. I believe he was in a film with his father called After Earth, which looked completely bad, and I heard that he was not so great in that. So may not have a career on the big screen as his dad did. And there's a nice moment when, you know, all the scientists are in the back of the truck. What are you? I'm an astrobiologist. I'm an engineer. I'm a physicist. I'm an astrophysicist, you know, which is kind of great. And when they're driving Jennifer Connelly towards this, she's like, well, I don't really believe you. I'm not taking you seriously. And they point ahead of her. The opposite side of the highway is full as it normally is, but the side that they're driving her on is completely empty. And we realize that the government has cleared the highway for her. You know, so I kind of like that, a visual sense of the stakes that are happening here. I don't like that they also have to verbally tell you it. She's like, well, you know, why is this such a big deal? Or I don't trust you. She doesn't really know what's going on and how big of a deal it is until the guy points ahead and we see that there's no traffic. And then he says, they cleared the highway. You know, it's like, when that happens in films, I immediately think that, you know, the writers already don't trust the material and they don't trust the audience. Like, really? Spielberg would have had a field day with that visually and you wouldn't have heard a word about the highway. And so you just, you know, you're in a different caliber of film here where, you know, they're pounding things in your head that absolutely don't need to be pounded into your head. So it's little things like that that start happening in a film where I start to go, oh, okay, you know, I see where we are here in the writing, and I kind of brace myself. So then they continue now, you know, with the buildup to the landing. They do a lot of buildup with the landing here, nothing like the original. We're at a military academy that's been taken over by the military, and there's a lot of hustle and bustle, and Helen knows someone who's at the head of sort of the science division of all of this military, these military people, played by actor John Hamm, who people know from Mad Men. So she gets in. She's supposed to have, you know, left her cell phone out, but she sneaks it in. So we get the quick and dirty that now, you know, we're in like the mission control area. We see radar, you know, very classic sci-fi, right? So they've discovered an object in the solar system that was initially moving on kind of a solar orbit, kind of like a comet, and then started to change course of its own power and on gravity, and now is heading straight towards Earth at an extremely high rate of speed, and it's going to impact New York City. You know, now we're gearing up towards sort of an Armageddon type scenario. The military is going to supposedly launch missiles to intercept it, but there's not enough time to evacuate Manhattan. It says only an hour and 18 minutes until impact. You know, she runs out and gets to a bathroom and she pulls her phone out and calls Jacob and has a last minute phone conversation. There's one nice moment here that I like. There's a knock on the door after she hangs up with her son, and it's a dumb conversation. Like, it doesn't, even in the annals of film dialogue, like, you know, something has to occur. Like, you're having a conversation with another character. It has to do something. Either has to illuminate the character and move the story forward, usually. And we know she's a good mom already, you know? Like, and nothing said here. It's just kind of very flat dialogue. But then when the knock comes on the stall door and we see a female army person there, like, is that a cell phone? And we think she's going to get busted. The woman's face changes and she's like, can I borrow it? And so, you know, which I kind of like, which is kind of a sense of like even the military is like, man, this could be the beginning of the end here. We don't know what this thing is going to do when it hits and they're not that far away. So I kind of like that little moment. Now we're ramping up the tension, you know, now we're in full on like, you know, they're in helicopters en route to the impact site. We hear from one of the military guys on the helicopter that the missiles were disabled, so it didn't have any effect. When we get this brief countdown, and then we have this anticlimax where nothing happens, and the object then slows and starts to track over Manhattan, moving under its own power. And it's a beautiful epic shot as it lands, because it's basically a big sphere, and it's, you know, it's throwing out a lot of light and causing these really cool shadows to happen as we're moving, you know, so it's kind of nice. But the CGI in this whole film is really glaring. They must have really been made on the cheap, because everything looks so fake. There's rarely a CGI shot in this film that doesn't look like 1998, you know, Godzilla. You know, it's really bad. It's really, really cartoony and cheesy. And it does take away from the power of the film, unfortunately. I think, you know, the onus is going to be on the story and the characters and the ideas in the film now to pull it out, because the visuals are not enough. And, you know, I'm not above a crappy movie with great visuals. I mean, the prequel trilogy, shall we say. I'm not above liking a crappy movie that has amazing visuals. You know, I just will. But this one already, the visuals are really, really bad. Just not done well. So you're like, okay, you know, some of the stuff is kind of epic and cool, but it's just the CGI continues to glare out at me. Now my brain's sort of like, okay, the dialogue's a little flat. The CGI is not great. And obviously in the original film, I have a remove from the 1950s. So yeah, when I'm taking for granted that things don't look anywhere near as realistic as they should, but it's a different era of filmmaking. So my brain kind of shuts that off, and I don't criticize films in the 50s for not looking realistic, you know, so they kind of have the advantage over modern films. But then again, to do bad special effects in our day and age is kind of insufferable. Like, come on, it's, you know, how do you not do good special effects? It's kind of all big budget films are made out of these days. That's the thing that seems to, even in, you know, terrible films you go see, the effects are usually great and perfectly done for the most part. How do you mess that up? So that's, you know, in a weird way, even though I'm giving a pass to David Yost's Still's effects, modern filmmaking that's anywhere in sci-fi genre, like, that's like, you know, job one. And the technology is so there to do it really well. It doesn't take much. You don't even have to design things well. Things can be designed in a very workmanlike manner, but just done crisply and really cool looking in the frame, and you're good to go. So that Day of the Earth That Stills fails at this is, to me, a real big problem with the. So now we get, the military hasn't arrived yet. All the scientists are there. They're in their biosuits. They've gotten there first via the helicopters. And the scientists' biosuits made me think of Klaatu's suit in the original. And I wonder if there was any design similarities, if they did that on purpose. The smoke finally clears, and now we get a really great shot of the sphere. I mean, it's beautifully designed. It's a larger version of what we saw in the prologue in India, you know, think the monolith, but a sphere. Again, you know, like sort of glowing marbles with liquid inside. Very cool. And now we get, and it's kind of a little too chunky or a little too thuddish in the script, where we're with the scientists looking at this beautiful thing. And then it's like, the soundtrack cue changes to a more martial one, and it's like the cops and the, you know, the cops and the army people show up and guns are being taken out, and it's like, you know, very much like the original, but it's a little clunky how they do it here. They really want you to be like tense and afraid of what's going to happen next. And there are some great shots here, bad CGI notwithstanding. There's a wonderful sense of scale of how small the people are, the massive ship, you know, it's like 40, 50 stories tall, and you know, you get these shots way up in the sky where the glow of the marble is sort of, we see all of the people standing around it and the shadows that they're throwing behind them. Very cool looking, you know, I like that. Klaatu finally emerges, barely visible. He kind of walks out of the marble in this light, and we hear on audio, and the sound design here is pretty good, this background of all the radios of all the cops in the army who've not been given proper rules of engagement. So they're like, what do? We fire? And they want her to pull back. So they keep saying, you know, Dr. Benson, do not advance. So it's obviously, right? This is what modern movies do. It's incredibly tense. We're on the edge of our seats. And finally, a hand reaches out towards Dr. Benson. Someone in the military shoots and the body drops and we see blood splashing on Dr. Benson. So we still haven't seen the figure yet. Now, like the original, the sphere reacts and there's a bit of a light shift. And this giant emerges, sort of like Gort on steroids. Again, it's like really 20, 30 stories tall. Huge with a singular eye, kind of very looks very Cylonish. Shuts down all the military systems and emits a sound that incapacitates everyone, you know, kind of a hypersonic. We see it about to reach down and grab Klaatu and or the doctor, but we hear, again, barely veiled, the figure that's down says something. The giant freezes and then stands back up and reverts to station keeping. And then all the power comes back up on all the military vehicles and so on and so forth. So Gort is really just a huge human figure, almost like a naked torso in metal, right? And it looks cool, but the CGI is so bad that it really looks like this is an anime. Really, it's like Gort the anime robot. It does not look real in any sense. And it's very similar to me of the robot that was in Thor. I think Thor came out maybe a year or two after this. I don't know who was first, but reminded me very similar of the first Thor film, the enemy robot, the Destroyer, I think they called it. It was about the same size. That looked really cool, a lot better. This just looks like really, really cheesy. The way Godzilla looked in the 1998 Godzilla film, just bad. And there's no getting around it. It's really a failure of visuals to have something look this fake in this kind of a movie. So it kind of ruins the moment. We cut right to the hospital. Basically, you know, Klaatu at this point is this big sort of oval blob, and they have no idea how to treat him, it. You know, we get a bit of like an ER steal in terms of, you know, give me 4 cc's of this, stat, get me this. And there's a lot of edits and cuts, you know, just like, okay, whatever. You know, we've seen this kind of crap before on TV. They defibrillate it, and it somehow stabilizes miraculously. And then this is kind of cool. The doctor who's there working realizes that there's a sort of a gelatinous goo that's encasing something underneath, and it's slowly sliding off. So he's sticking his hands in this goo and pulling it off the body. And finally, it all comes off, and we see at the center of this thing is this sort of human figure. Very CGI, and it sort of slowly, you know, crawls into a fetal ball, but very human looking. And then we briefly fade as time has passed, and we see through kind of, it's now in this like plastic bubble, and we see through some of the bubble's windows that is now looking like the climber from the prologue, and it's becoming fully Keanu. At this point, we now shift over to the world situation, and we're seeing the panic in response to the landing. So they do kind of a 100-mile up. They do both in the remake. They do the 100-mile up kind of, we're at the seat of the leadership of the U.S., and they also do, you know, the character level as well. They've halted trading globally as Manhattan is now preparing for evacuation. And now we're introduced to Regina Jackson, I believe the Secretary of State, who is the sort of voice of the president. She's the analog to Harley in the original film. I'm speaking for the president. And we're on Air Force One, and we hear of other smaller spheres now that have landed worldwide. So in this film, we are getting a little bit of an escalation of the invasion or the contact, as it were. There are all these other spheres besides the initial one. In the original, all we have is this singular spaceship and the singular character and Gort. What we're talking about here is that the aliens accessed a very specialized defense satellite, which was used as sort of a backdoor for the aliens to get into the military mainframes to shut down missile defense system, which is why none of the missiles fired. I'm like, okay, that's cool. You know, if it's going to matter in the film, doesn't really. So whatever. You know, their technology is incredibly higher here. And we're going to get into this little thing of sort of higher versus lower technology, which I kind of like that this film brings up. It's kind of neat. Regina Jackson is saying that, you know, the aliens, there's an enormous amount of information on that mainframe, and the aliens know a lot about the human race, and the human race knows next to nothing about the aliens. So we cut back to the hospital. They analyze the being that's there, and we're told that it's 3 types of DNA. The body tissue is human. The flesh encasement is something that's completely different, and whatever, you know, it's 3 types of DNA. Okay, it's, you know, cool sci-fi jargon. Doesn't mean squat in terms of the movie. We realize as a viewer that the DNA sample from the climber is what was used to create the body. Great, nice. And now, 30 minutes into the film, we're finally getting our first conversation between Klaatu and Jackson, which happened way earlier in the original. Big change. Bates is not very good in this film. You know, she made a huge splash in Misery and kind of put her on the map. But I've not found her to be very good in certain types of roles. And this is one of them. You know, when she's sort of cast as a higher up person in charge, she just doesn't have a natural sense of command about her. And there are other women that, you know, like you put, when you put, think of Judi Dench as M, Judi Dench has a natural aura of command that she can throw on. You know, I don't see Judi Dench acting. She's not overcompensating for a natural lack to become how, you know, M is. And we don't believe for a minute that she is not M and completely in charge of Bond at every moment. But here, Kathy Bates is she's like Meryl Streep in the Manchurian Candidate remake. Like, it's too much. She's pushing too much because she doesn't have that natural gravity of power. I think you needed a different actress here to do this who had a natural sense of command. Kathy Bates just doesn't have it. So I don't really buy her in this role. So most of her dialogue is really not very effective in my book. But Keanu's great, actually, you know, and I'm not the biggest Keanu fan, but I think just in response to who he's playing around, like, no one in the military is very interesting to watch. Jennifer Connelly's good, but she's given absolutely nothing to do. Jaden Smith is bad. And, you know, John Hamm has pretty much nothing to do either. So Keanu kind of has a center in this movie, which is kind of cool, you know, so he's pretty good. So it's kind of the same dialogue as the original. He cannot speak to just the U.S., but the assembled nations of the Earth. And again, Keanu is very centered here. His kind of whoa dude persona is very alien, you know. In a sense, he is kind of alien-ish as a persona, and it's a perfect fit for Klaatu, I think. So again, as I said before, very still, very centered presence. And now, you know, we have Regina Jackson shift into paranoia mode. So she's debating his cryptic answers and is completely freaked out. And has decided to basically waterboard, sedate him, torture him, and get the information she needs through these measures. And this is where, again, the film starts to become very pedestrian. Where the initial film, all this was veiled behind a threat of that he just couldn't leave right away. But you had a very intelligent man who was there saying, you know, look, we're a mess right now, but I'm also, you know, a representative of this mess, and there are certain things I can't let you do. Where she's right away like, you know, we're going to get what we want. And it's just not very interesting. You know, say what you want about it. It's just a classic, like, she's a bad guy and he now has to escape. And I'm just kind of bored with it right away. What I do like here is they throw up this notion of nations who colonize and the nations that they colonize. And it's the Regina Jackson character has the line, you know, it's the nation with usually the less technology, which ends up on the short end of the stick. And, you know, you immediately think about, you know, the Europeans in the 16th, 1700s, the massive age of colonization, right? And so that's kind of cool, where the less advanced civilization is either enslaved or exterminated, I believe, is the line. Immediately, she needs a volunteer to inject him with, you know, what, sodium pentothal, right? It's the usual drug, so they can scramble his brains and get what they need, and no one will do it. All the scientists say they won't do it. And Helen Benson actually agrees to do it, but we see her. When she goes into sort of the area where all the drugs are kept, she grabs a bottle of saline, which she puts in her pocket. And then this creepy-faced dude kind of fronts around her and says, you'll use this solution on him, you know, gives it to her. So we understand why she did what she did. It's okay. It's clever. This last standoff now, and Helen injects him with the saline and whispers, run, before leaving. And so they wheel him into this interrogation room. And this is a pretty good scene. There's a really creepy actor playing the interrogator, who's just very monotone, asking him these questions. Put electrodes on his head. It's a great, cool little set, you know, very intense. As it begins, we see some weird energy throwing off the machine. So the guy starts asking him questions, and then there's this weird moment where Klaatu sort of zaps him with something, and he goes horizontal and then back vertical, and then Klaatu is now interrogating him. So, you know, where are the exits, where are all of, which is great. It's kind of cool. And we see him looking through some fiber optics back into cameras to find out where all the guards are. He steps up his game now and uses some of his alien tech to orally incapacitate all the guards. So he kind of zaps whatever their hearing devices are. They're all wearing some, you know, some microphones and earpieces, and he uses them to sort of incapacitate them, probably with sound, which is great. We flash to Helen briefly putting a sample of the goo that Klaatu is encased in her pocket, which there's no reason she should do that. But, you know, we're going to need it later in the movie, so she does it. There's a moment where Klaatu is like, what size suit is that? You know, and so Klaatu puts on the guy's suit who's interrogating him and calmly walks out as all the guards are writhing on the ground and he is gone. So, you know, in this one, we see how Klaatu gets out versus the original. And it's a pretty clever scene for a sci-fi film. You know, I kind of like it where everything's fed back. He uses everything against them. And then, of course, now, you know, we have Kathy Bates on the other side doing a bad impression of Tommy Lee Jones in the fugitive, you know, like, I want this and I want people there and, you know, and I want people looking and call this and do that. And you're just like, okay, you know, the BS cliche manhunt patois that these characters use. So I will pause there in the remake now to kind of compare the openings of the two films. So first of all, the original film, to do the same thing, it took 21 minutes. The remake took 41 minutes. So there's an extra 20 minutes of film in the remake. The original is very singular in purpose. It's very simple. It's very stripped down. It shows the reason for the entire film in a very straight telling. And the non-reveal of Klaatu's intentions are kind of all the drama that's necessary, I think. You know, he's there. We don't know why he's there. He's got this crazy robot. He was shot. He revived. A lot of other mysteries that are not told to us. There's an initial pushback by the U.S. We get this notion of uncooperative nations. So a sense of what's going to be in his way, which is great. And so once he leaves, we're now ready to begin the human drama that comes. So it's a great chock-a-block setup, very intelligent, maybe a little too minimal. You know, maybe they, you know, a little more setup might have been needed, but not really, because, I mean, take, for example, as the remake, right? It's twice the amount of time, and you spend all this time with, you're building up tension. It uses all these devices. It uses a prologue. We meet the characters before the spaceship gets there. Everything is jacked up to massive effect. They use every possible place they can put some drama. They put it there. And okay, that's fine, you know, but it's like, at the end of the day, when Klaatu leaves the facility, I mean, okay, maybe it's a little more exhilarating in that we're at the edge of our seats the whole way and now he's gone. So it's possible that as a viewer, people are like, oh my God, what is going to happen next? This has been incredible. It's a mystery. I've been on the edge of my seat from the moment I started. No, and I'm like, okay, I kind of get that. But at the same time, as this film works, as the remake goes on, you realize that it's an empty shell, and that all it does is truck in these kind of tension-building devices. So it works for the beginning, because really the first 20 minutes of a film is a gift to filmmakers. You know, like, you're in the theater, you got me. You can do pretty much anything you want. It really takes, as hard as impossible it is to end a film, it's kind of hard and impossible to screw up the beginning of one, you know, especially when you have such a high concept as this one and all the pieces you're moving into place. So, however, I still really like the clarity of the original. And what splits the film beginningly right here is the Regina Jackson character versus Mr. Harley in the original, and where the film splits. And that, you know, Kathy Bates' character is the classic military character. We don't trust you. We're going to do what we want. We don't believe you. And to me, in 2008, that is a boring character. I have seen that character more times than you can possibly imagine. So as a genre viewer, I'm tired of that character. To see a non-cliched character in that role in 1951 movie, to me, blows me away. That Mr. Harley comes here, and Harley to me is more sinister than Bates is, because he's smart and he understands. And at the same time, who the hell knows which way this guy's going to twitch as well. So, and I don't need any more excess drama after the opening. It's like, man, you know, only in, you know, the 2000s do we need more drama after we see a spaceship land on the planet and an enigmatic man state that he must talk to all nations of the Earth at the same time. Do I need an idiot military character or political character barking stuff? It's just boring to me, and it doesn't play into the movie. You know, she's just the Tommy Lee Jones character, constantly barking and where we're chasing him and let's get him and all this crap, and it's boring. Again, the intelligence of the original, for me, is a trump card on all of the narrative, movie-going, dramatic tricks.
The economics of the future are somewhat different. You see, money doesn't exist in the 24th century.
I can't wait for that day to come, but unfortunately, it is not here yet. I just want to briefly tell you a couple of ways you can support Sci-Fi On Screen. If you like the show and you want to support us, you can support by using Patreon. And Patreon's a crowdfunding site that works by allowing people to donate per show. So the way it works is you would sign up on Patreon and set yourself up. It's a snap. You can do patreon.com. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Or on my website, sci-fionscreen.com, there's a big link on the top right-hand corner. You sign up, you set it, you decide how much you want to contribute. It could be as little as a dollar a show or as high as you like. Every time I upload a podcast, it'll debit you that amount. So it's not a, you know, you're not paying me every month. If weeks go by and I don't put up shows, you're not paying me anything. It's a really great way to support podcasters so you know that you're not getting taken because you're only paying as the show comes up. If you want to make a one-time donation, you can use PayPal and you can use the scifionscreen@gmail.com email, and you can search on PayPal with that email address and you'll find my account and you can make a one-time donation via PayPal. That's scifionscreen@gmail.com. And you can also support the show by retweeting us on Twitter, share us on your Facebook page, please write a review on iTunes. Just to remind you also that you can find all of my shows archived on my website. There's a page on the site that's called Index of by Movies. So you can just, every movie is done alphabetically, and you can see all the shows there and download and listen as you like.
Gonna crack my knuckles and jump for joy. I got a clean bill of health from Dr. McCoy.
So now I'm going to compare the two films from the moment of Klaatu out of captivity to the meeting with the respective Professor Barnhart's, which they happen in both films. It takes a little longer to get there in the remake, but I think it's good to sort of parallel the journeys. So back to the original. We pick up Klaatu now walking with a suitcase, and we hear a radio broadcast blaring nearby. There's always, you know, we're always clued into the larger situation in the original film by either hearing voiceovers or montages or hearing the radio. We see that he's taken the clothes that he's wearing from a cleaner along with a valise, so it looks kind of like a regular working Joe. And he enters a boarding house just as everyone in the boarding house is watching a warning news broadcast about him. But since there's no photograph, no one's thinking of taking a photograph of him, no one knows what he looks like. So he meets briefly with Helen, who's played by Patricia Neal, and Bobby, her son. This is Sunday morning. They're all at breakfast. All of the boarders of the boarding house are around the table. They're sitting around Sunday morning breakfast, and the boarders now are having a discussion about him. You know, most of them are kind of frightened and, you know, are demanding his destruction and very aggressive towards him. Not him there, but him, Klaatu, as the, you know, the man from space. And Patricia Neal, the one person, Helen, is the lone standout who is not so sure of how to, you know, of what his intentions might be. I was struck immediately here by the fact that this is taking place in a boarding house, and we're seeing a single woman with a child. You know, 1950s films, to see a single woman and a child in this kind of a place, very atypical, you know, and they're all eating together. Like, they're not living out in the suburbs where you see, you know, every other movie made in this time period, it's basically, you know, Main Street USA, families out in houses and backyards and families. And so I was really struck by that, that they showed, you know, some single folks and a single mom and her son at this boarding house. So really cool. Then a very anachronistic thing happens, and that Tom, who's Helen's boyfriend, calls on her on a Sunday and wants to take her out, but she doesn't have a babysitter for Bobby. So, you know, Klaatu, who's announced himself as Mr. Carpenter, walks up to her and says, "I'd be happy to watch your son today while you go out." And of course, she relents. You know, imagine, it's 2016, right? A strange man in a boarding house who you've just met taking an interest in your son would be happy to watch him for the day. You know, I just thought, oh my God, what an anachronism. It was really interesting. Klaatu takes Bobby out for the day, and they just go travel around, and they go to Arlington Cemetery, where we see that Bobby's father is buried there, and he was killed in World War II. So, and they also do this in the remake. We're having the son, you know, the son's father dead. So there's some conversation here about having money, because Klaatu wants to do things with Bobby, but he doesn't have any money. So he takes out these two beautifully cut diamonds and says, "Hey, Bobby, would you trade $2 for these two diamonds, which are probably worth, you know, thousands and thousands?" And of course, Bobby does. So then we cut to the Lincoln Memorial, and he's reading the words inside the memorial and is very impressed. He asks Bobby where such a man as, you know, Lincoln may be found. And Bobby mentions a Professor Barnhart who lives in Washington. So we get right to the Barnhart plot here. But before that, Bobby wants to go see the flying saucer. So Klaatu takes him to see the saucer. In a very wise and knowing scene, you see Bobby and Klaatu standing with a large group of passersby, and the reporter is there with a microphone and a cameraman, and of course he's trolling for, you know, newsworthy responses, very knee-jerk, either the aliens should die or I'm afraid of the aliens. And so when he finally gets to Klaatu, his answer is very complex and subtle, and in the middle of his answer, the guy just kind of thanks him and moves on. I just thought it was very, you know, very sharp for 1950. I thought it was an incredibly wise scene. You know, in a trick of movie magic, Bobby knows where this, you know, the greatest professor in the U.S. lives, right? So they head over there. It's kind of goofy. There's this blackboard, and they kind of, you know, it's, again, 1950s. They just walk into his house. Klaatu opens the door, and they just kind of walk in, and there are these equations on the blackboard. And so we, you know, we get a sense that Klaatu is completely understands. He's like, he's on the right track, but he's, you know, he's going in the wrong direction. So we see Klaatu making corrections and changes on the blackboard, which I think is a great idea, and they steal it in the remake, which I think is really clever. And the housekeeper comes in and freaks out that he's writing on the board, and so Klaatu gives the housekeeper his address. We cut later on that evening. Agents come to bring him back to Professor Barnhart. So now we set up, after Klaatu leaves, we're now starting to set up the relationship between Helen and Tom, which is something that does not happen in the remake, and I think it's really interesting in this film, and I think it kind of is thematically important. There's a brief moment where Helen and Tom are sitting in a car, and he's kind of trying to huckster her into marriage. Like, but I forget exactly what it was, but he's sort of making a deal. Hey, look, if you marry me, I'll give you this, and you can have that. And he's joking, but it's also kind of he really wants her to agree, and it's part of his character that later on in this movie, he's basically a huckster and a salesman, and he's going to look for the quick buck and the sure moneymaker, which will eventually lead him to splitting from Helen. So I like that it's kind of a throwaway line here, but if you've watched the movie several times, you realize that it's the beginning of showing Tom's character. So we cut right back to Barnhart's place, and he reveals himself to the professor, and the professor, of course, accepts him, and so his mission is revealed. He reveals his mission to the professor that he belongs to sort of a galactic neighborhood of civilizations, and they've been monitoring Earth, and now that Earth has atomic power and rocketry, they threaten the local galactic neighborhood, which, you know, the civilization that Klaatu is part of cannot permit. He still holds off on revealing the complete picture, holding on to his earlier assertion that, you know, he's got to get everyone together. Barnhart says, listen, you know, maybe we can't get the leaders of the country together. What if we get all the scientific minds of all the country who are the real intellectual leaders of the country? And sort of Klaatu agrees, but also he reveals that if things continue to drag out, Earth is going to be eliminated completely. So the big foot drops. And Klaatu asks Barnhart if a massive demonstration might shake the people into Earth, into sort of waking up and recognizing that he means business. And Bernhard suggests a demonstration that's nonviolent. And Klaatu sort of says, okay, you know, around noon tomorrow, it's going to affect the whole planet. It's going to be done. So we've quickly, you know, set up the title of the film, The Day the Earth Stood Still, and we're going to go from there. So, okay, so now let's shift to the remake and the remake's progress towards Klaatu meeting with Professor Barnhart. Again, we rejoin Klaatu in the guise of Keanu Reeves as he is in a train station, and we see that he's got the thing that Klaatu has power over in the remake is electrical items. So there's some connection between his powers and electricity, and also this little, you know, the gel that he has. So this sort of these things go together. So, you know, we see him get a sandwich from a machine in a public place by just putting his hand over the plate, and of course it, you know, pops out a machine. Now, there's this weird scene where Klaatu observes kind of a huckster guy in the train station steal a ticket from a guy. The camera follows this scene. Like, it kind of makes a point of showing us that this one guy has stolen a ticket from the other guy, and the other guy who's running after him saying, hey, that guy stole my ticket. And then the guy collapses and has a heart attack, which is just bizarre. So it was just a really weird scene. I'm not really sure what the hell it was doing in the movie. However, soon after, Klaatu goes into the bathroom and he collapses because he hasn't healed completely from the bullet wound, which we see. So now we cut over to Helen's house. Inexplicably, Helen and Jacob are now back in their house as if nothing has happened, which is kind of weird. So she gets a phone call that someone she supposedly knows is in the train station and please come pick him up. There's a couple of the way they do the dialogue, she recognizes that it's probably Klaatu. So she gets there and grabs him, and it's way too easy a getaway after we've heard the Secretary of Defense, you know, go on her tirade about locking things down and photographs and all this stuff. But anyway, he's very shaky, and they get away. And in the car, he takes the little vial of sort of the encasing flesh that he was born in, takes a little piece of it, rubs it on the gunshot wound, and it completely heals the wound. So we've got this little bit of information. So then we cut to the military taking their very first shot at Gort. And, you know, very modern. We're using drones. And we've got goofy military guys, which, you know, whatever. And we follow the drones through the city. And as the drones use laser guiding systems, Gort feeds back through the laser guiding systems, destroying, first of all, he destroys the missiles that they've launched. Then he uses the drone, takes control of them, and crashes them into tanks, which is very cool. And it, you know, one thing they do hear about the powers that Gort and Klaatu have to some degree is they are all powers that use the enemy's defenses. You know, Klaatu, when he escaped from the military base, kind of used all the military's things against them. And Gort kind of follows suit by using the weapons of the enemy against themselves, which I kind of like. So, you know, it's kind of a cool thing. Now we cut back and we start the relationship between Helen, Klaatu, and Jacob. And, you know, Jacob's talking about how we should kill the aliens and not take the chance in case they're bad people. And there's some tension between him and Helen. He's an annoying little actor, and I never really feel like this kid is really anything real. It's just, you know, Will Smith's kid, and he's not a very good actor. At some point, Klaatu wants them to go to, I believe it's a McDonald's, hello product placement, and we meet this old Asian man who's there. So he and Klaatu meet, and the Asian guy's nephew and Jacob and Helen all sit at kind of a different booth, and just Klaatu and this older man sit together. And side note, it's the same actor who played the Chinese restaurant maitre d' in the Seinfeld episode, The Chinese Restaurant. Seinfeld 4, same guy, very funny. So they speak in Mandarin, which I kind of like, and we get a little subtitle on the screen. I'm sure the suits are very happy that maybe it would play in China. So this bit of a change in the plot. The old Chinese man is one of the aliens. He is a being like Klaatu, and he's been on the planet for like 70 years. He's been out of contact for a long, long time. And he advises Klaatu that any attempt to intervene with human beings is futile, that they're completely dangerous and unchangeable. And yet, it's a nice little monologue that the old guy doesn't, you know, something is coming. I don't think we got it explicitly said yet, but the old guy doesn't want to leave. He's like, when it comes time for them to die, I will die as one of them. That he's cherished his life and actually loves them, even though they're doomed, which is delivered very simply and very effectively. Unfortunately, it's a very isolated moment in this film, and they don't do much more with it. But I don't know, I was really impressed by it. I really thought that maybe, you know, they would build on that. You know, part of me was thinking in that moment that a cool idea, well, I mean, you know, it was there in the film, right? That maybe the race that Klaatu and this man are from once were very much like human beings. And in order to ascend into the beings that they are now, they had to leave behind a certain part of themselves in order to join a galactic neighborhood and be part of a larger civilization, that there were certain parts of them that were like seriously dangerous that either had to change or be bred out of them or something. But that they also lost something as well. So, I don't know, it just made me think it might be a really thorny, interesting idea. I mean, the film doesn't do anything with it, but I thought, you know, the movie that I was playing in my head, I thought, wow, how cool would it be that, you know, even maybe Klaatu remembers that what they used to be like, that they used to love and have these incredible emotional lives as human beings do, but in order for them to join the greater galactic neighborhood, those things had to be left behind. So, I don't know, I was kind of happy that this scene was in the film and that it did spark a little side story in my head. I don't think it was uh, the the point of the film to do that, or, you know, it's just kind of making it up. But I don't know, it's just that's what it made me think of, and I thought it was really a neat idea. So we cut back to Central Park, and Gort is now being contained within these three metal panels. They kind of bottle him up, and there's a visible sigh of relief from the military as nothing happens. And then we're right back to Helen and Klaatu as they drive out of the city. We hear over the police scanners that he's been recognized at McDonald's. He leads them into the woods, where he finds a small sphere, which is a smaller version of the big ship in Central Park. And there, we've seen through earlier that there are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of these all around the globe, maybe even more. And the sphere rises up and draws in all kinds of wildlife into itself. He touches it, and it seems to have some effect on the large one in Central Park. So he's, you know, we see that he's definitely setting something in motion. And in all the other ones across the globe, we see them now drawing in the wildlife as if they were Ark. So then we cut right back to military, and we see them watching this happen, realizing that you know, these spheres are everywhere online and drawing animals to it. Now, there's more dialogue in this car that's still in the woods between Helen and Jacob that has absolutely no shape, and Jacob is very annoying. There's no, you know, they're not building him. Jacob supposedly the reason that Klaatu changes his mind later on, and there's absolutely no reason for it to happen. We don't see anything about this kid or what this kid is experiencing or going through at all. And so every time they do dialogue with the mother, there's no shape to it, and it doesn't do anything. It's just there. So, you know, as movie watchers, we kind of know what's happening. So at this point, now we get the reveal. The Klaatu explains to Helen that it's not the original about joining the Galactic Neighborhood and the danger due to their atomic weapons. And it's a very clever idea that there are very few habitable planets that can support complex life in the universe. Like, it turns out that the Earth is a very rare place, and there's not many of them. So what he has come to do is save the Earth. So, you know, in earlier lines, we hear that I'm here to save the Earth. And of course, you know, as movie and sci-fi watchers, we immediately think that he's here to save humanity. But in a very clever syntactical red herring, he's actually here to save the Earth itself, which is being killed by human beings. So in very clunky dialogue, he explains if the Earth dies, humanity dies. If humanity dies, the Earth lives. It's like, okay, you know, thanks for the kindergarten version of it. But, you know, it's a really cool concept. And I could see why it would have spawned the idea for a remake, because it's a great idea. And then, you know, we have, unfortunately, now what purports to the people around Klaatu wanting to say, no, we can change. And Jennifer Connelly's Helen is begging him, no, we can't change. We really can. And yeah, as you're watching the movie, it comes off as incredibly hollow for her and for the story. It's why this version of the story is very dumb. We can change. No, really. And she's crying like, really? Like, this is a historical, powerful moment. Like, what possible evidence do you have that we can change? And it's kind of ridiculous. So we don't get too much further. Cops enter the clearing, and we get a brief aside that even if he's captured, the process is going to continue without him. And a very strange scene, the cop comes in, and Klaatu puts his hands on the car as he's directed and uses his power to throw the car completely against the cop, killing him. And of course, Jacob comes out of the car, you kill the guy. And then he uses some more of his magic flesh, puts it inside the guy's mouth, and then draws power from the car to revive him. And I just thought, what's the point of all this? You know, like, okay, so Klaatu's not a bad guy so much. He's, you know, what was the point of saving him if he's going to wipe out the human race anyway? And at this point in the film, he hasn't changed his mind. It's been made up. So it's just a very shapeless film, and there's really no reason for most of the stuff that's going on here. Where have we been? In a McDonald's and out in the woods. So it's just very, very odd. So now we're an hour in, and Helen's like, I'm going to take you to our real leaders. And of course, it's a little more plausible that the Klaatu in the remake gets the Barnhart, because Helen is a scientist, so she knows him. They go. Before they get there, we cut back to the command station, and we see Regina Jackson figuring out that it's an Ark, and now they understand what's going on, so they kind of get it. And at the same time, we see them, they've taken Gort to some undisclosed facility, and they're lowering him down this massively long shaft. We have the Barnhart scene, and a wonderful casting choice. John Cleese plays Professor Barnhart. He's woefully way too little screen time. He's very good. Jacob goes in the other room and is watching television, and he's seeing on TV now pictures of Klaatu, and that he's wanted and he's a dangerous person and all that stuff. So, you know, that's going to set up what's going to happen very quickly. And they do something here that I really like, where there's no dialogue. So when Barnhart and Klaatu meet each other, I think Klaatu's writing something on his blackboard. Barnhart goes to the other end of the blackboard and writes something. And they start correcting each other's work and then building on each other's work. And there's no dialogue. It's really great. I really like the scene. Then, of course, we realize that Barnhart recognizes who Klaatu is. And then we're starting to get some evidence of, you know, why Klaatu's going to change his mind, where he hears Bach playing in the speakers and he says, "What is that? It's beautiful." Then we cut to this military bunker where we've just seen Gort. They name it Gort by calling it a genetically organized robotic technology, which is very clever. You know, I kind of think it's funny when remakes have to come up with acronyms where original films didn't bother. Like, remember in Caprica, when they were naming a Cylon, a cybernetic life form node, Cylon, right? So somebody had to come up with that. And I felt like it was like the same thing here in where they had to come up with, could they use the word Gort? I mean, they didn't have to, right? But it's kind of clever that they did. I thought it was kind of fun. Like the original, it's completely impervious to scanning and diamond drills. We're in a little control room and all we see is Gort's upper torso. So the size of Gort is still pretty incredible. And the CGI is a little bit better here. It's a bit cleaner, a bit clearer. It's a little bit more real, but still, you know, not the best. So now we get the conversation proper between Barnhart and Klaatu. And Klaatu says that, you know, we've rarely ever seen civilizations like yours evolve past their warlike level. Barnhart asks him, well, how did you guys do it? And he said, well, we were faced with extinction due to our sun was dying. And so, you know, with such an event, we were forced to evolve in certain ways to save ourselves. So Barnhart uses this to try to convince him that humanity is at that same brink, and that give them a chance to, at this brink, work past it. And again, I don't know what brink he's talking about. Like, most of the people on the planet, you know, before Gort got there, half of us think, you know, environmental science is bunk. And there's no sense other than, you know, I guess what Barnhart was saying is somehow, it's a weird film because I think in this moment, what needed to happen is Barnhart needed to say, listen, well, we need to be faced with our brink too. Can you bring that about? Yeah, it happens at the very end of the film, where the film ends with the lights out moment. At that point, it's just weird. It comes after the fact, so you're not really, you're like, okay, we're going to get a chance to start again, but it really wasn't our brink moment. We're just going to build the same civilization all over again. So it's just, the film doesn't know what it wants to do, I think. It's possible there were several writers who got in here and messed stuff about, because it doesn't make any sense. You know, in the original, it makes sense that they're going to turn off the lights to get everyone to listen. But if they're going to go with what Barnhart is saying and that they need to be faced with an extinction-level event, you know, just turning off all the lights, yeah, there'll be a dieback, but it's not something that's going to evolve them to another level. So I found like it was very confusing in that way. And, you know, another nail in the coffin of us hating the Jacob character, he calls the cops on Klaatu, and so, you know, we're left in this scene with these helicopters coming and Klaatu's seeing them. You know, we realize, of course, that Jacob called the cops, so... So I'll pause there. Now, I wanted to continue with the time clock. At this point in the remake, we're an hour and 12 minutes into the film. And at this point in the original, we're only 45 minutes in. What has each film done, right, in this moment? From the moment that Klaatu got out of his confinement, we set up the Tom and Helen subplot, and we've actually done some character work on both. We've done some character work on Helen. We've seen Tom kind of hint at what kind of person he might be. We see Klaatu actually getting a sense of our civilization, not just running around in McDonald's and, you know, going to the woods. Like, he goes to the graveyard. He's talking to Bobby about war. He goes to the Lincoln Memorial, and we get a sense of how great we can be. He gives Bobby the diamonds, which sets up a plot later. So there's all this story work going on. They're setting a lot of things up, and they do it very efficiently. So you're only 45 minutes in when this is done. And now, you know, at an hour 12 in the remake, what do we have? Like, all we really know is that, you know, there's no relationships here between anybody. We've gotten a lot of whining and no real relationship building between Klaatu and Jacob at all, or Helen and Jacob, because there's not been any alone time between Klaatu and Jacob. So there's no relationship to build there. They've always been together. And Jacob's just kind of a whiny little brat. Helen, as played by Jennifer Connelly, there's nothing there. They're just driving him around, and he's doing stuff, and we, the audience, are kind of clued in as to what the story is, but you know, those characters are not making any decisions that matter and nothing's really happening. And all this contemporary film stuff to me is like empty window dressing, because what's really going on here? Like, you know, I'm not swept into this film. It's not building any interesting argument. There's really one cool plot idea about him there to save the Earth and not people, which is great. We get an attack on Gort. You know, we're cutting back and forth to a lot of things to kind of distract us from the fact that there's no bloody story here. So to my mind, the original is doing better with the intelligence of what it's saying and in its storytelling chops, frankly. It's just telling a very clean story and giving you things that are going to matter later in the film. Whereas this film is just meandering around, throwing some effects at you and a lot of hazy mumbo jumbo, and it's not doing much, you know. So just interesting to compare. Okay, so now we're going to move into the last part of both movies. The original takes a little longer. There's a little bit more to come in terms of me following the two films as they progressed so far. So in the original film, we are now back at the rooming house, and there's this great scene, again, very anachronistic and kind of creepy, to 2016 ears, where Klaatu is talking to Helen about her son and how great he is. He's a great boy. He's very smart. He's very this. He's very that, you know. And so Tom, Helen's boyfriend, is getting a bit jealous about Carpenter, Klaatu, who's, you know, really hitting it off with the son. Tom could care less about Bobby. So, you know, he's going after, you don't really know this guy, and, you know, you're letting him pal around with your son, and, you know, he has a point, actually. But so she goes upstairs, and she catches Carpenter in Bobby's room, helping him with his homework, right? So it kind of spooks her. So later that night, now, Bobby sees Klaatu going out, and he borrows a flashlight from him, and he follows him out, which is a little crazy, because, you know, Bobby's not very old. So to follow Klaatu through the streets of Washington, D.C. at his age, it's a little nuts, but you know, it's needed for the plot for the film. Klaatu goes back to the ship, which is still guarded, but barely. You know, it's so funny how kind of naive, or just maybe the film just doesn't do it justice, but the ship's not very badly guarded that Bobby can sneak nearby just by hiding behind trees. It's kind of funny. We see Klaatu manipulate Gort by using the flashlight to do some sort of, you know, some kind of on-off Morse code-ish kind of stuff. And he turns around and knocks the guards out, and then Klaatu gets into the ship. And we see him inside the ship doing something. We're not sure what. So later, Bobby's telling Helen that, you know, I've seen Klaatu. He went to a ship, and they're like, oh, Bobby, you know, you had a bad dream. And so Tom goes up to get Klaatu, enters his room because he's not there, and finds one of the diamonds. Takes it down to Helen and Bobby, and of course, Bobby says, gives him the other one, saying, oh yeah, he's got a bunch of them. And now, of course, you know, Tom is completely like, this guy's probably a criminal. I gotta have him checked out. And at the end, when Bobby's about to walk back upstairs, they both notice that his shoes are wet. So, you know, kind of they didn't believe that he witnessed all the things that he witnessed, and now that they see his shoes are wet, you know, it's kind of like, well, maybe he did. So the next day, Helen's at her job, and during lunch, Klaatu shows up and kind of buttonholes her, very anxious about what Bobby told her. At one point at noon, which is when the, you know, the event was supposed to happen, the elevator gets stuck, and they're in the elevator, and Helen turns to Klaatu and says, what is this about? She's like, oh, don't worry, it'll last about 20 minutes. So now she realizes who he is, and now we get the big moment in the film, which was, you know, teased by the title. And we're back in montage mode, and here's what we see, which I think is really interesting. We see a few street scenes in Washington, D.C., a couple of street scenes in New York, one in London, the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, what looks like Moscow or St. Petersburg, then inside a power plant somewhere, then the New Haven line of the Metro North Railroad stopped, right? All these things that we're seeing, nothing's moving. We see a woman pulling soaked laundry out of a washing machine that stopped. A fisherman can't start his outboard. A woman working in a pharmacy can't make a milkshake. A farmer can't milk his cows with his sort of auto-milking machine. People stuck on a roller coaster. A car assembly line that stopped. A drawbridge that stuck open. A train motionless on a stretch of track. And now back to D.C. as a groundskeeper can't start his lawnmower. Then we get into Dr. Barnard's office, and it's very effective. First of all, it's completely silent, and we don't hear any voiceover or any dialogue or anything, but it kind of shows people in all their walks of life affected by the outage. And for a moment, you know, the world seems a bit smaller. It's a really, really effective sequence in the film. Very impressive, even now watching it. It's very, very well done. So we also hear, because immediately we think, if everything lost power, what about planes and hospitals? And planes and hospitals were not affected, you know. So it's this supreme power that Klaatu and his people possess. And we hear that from a group of generals talking around the table. We cut to a jewelry store where Tom has taken one of Klaatu's diamonds, and the jeweler tells him he's never seen such a stone anywhere. Helen, finally, we get to this moment in the elevator where Helen says, you know, I'll keep your secret. He asks about Bobby, but Helen's more worried about Tom because, you know, Tom's kind of on the march now. It's going to be up to her to try to keep Tom silent. Around the table, the generals are talking, and they talk about how they've encased Gort in something called KL-93, which is a plastic-like substance, which is kind of funny. We see Gort encased in that. And they changed the capture order on Klaatu to a kill order. Washington is now quarantined, and we get yet another montage showing all the quarantine sort of activity, roadblocks, and, you know, stopping people. So now we get the moment of Tom's character, which I like. Helen comes to his office, and they have this big moment of, we both know that he's the man from space, and Tom is like starry-eyed with his own glory. He wants to be like, I'm going to be the biggest man in the country, baby. I'm going to blow the lid off this. And she begs him, you know, please don't say anything for me, and you have to understand what this man is. And she says, look, the wedding's off. We're done. You know, if you go through with this, we're finished. And he could care less at this point. He doesn't chase her. He completely is, like, mad with glory and wanting to, you know, be the man. And so he does get to the general. He calls this famous general, who now mobilizes everyone to come after Klaatu. And I like that. I like that they're showing Tom's character. They're showing, you know, they're showing the split sides of humanity here. We're, you know, the power hungry, money grubbing Toms of the world, right? And then there's the Helens of the world and the Bobbies of the world. So we're getting kind of, I don't know, for me, it's like a bit of a snapshot of different types of humanity that Klaatu is witness to, which, you know, I don't get a lot of that in the remake, but, you know, we'll get to that. You know, they're on the run, and Klaatu is really worried, and he tells Helen that Gort has the power to destroy the entire planet. He gives her the classic words that we all know. In case he's killed, she's to say these words to Gort to save the planet, Klaatu Barada Nikto, right, which is the classic words. Right afterwards, they're in this car. Klaatu gets out of the car, and he's gunned down by the military and killed, which is pretty hardcore, way hardcore, more hardcore than the remake. So now we cut to Gort. He's encased in this plastic cube. He begins to burn it. He vaporizes two soldiers that approach him. And now Helen approaches, and Robert, the director, really plays it for suspense. Helen's paralyzed with fear, and she can't say the words. So we have this very creature feature moment where Helen falls to the ground, screaming, her arms over her face, and Gort approaching. We see the shadow. His visor opens, and he's about to kill her, and she says the words twice. Gort, you know, he picks Helen up, carries her into the ship. And then we see Gort leave the ship without her. We cut to then a police holding cell that has Klaatu's body, and Gort burns a hole in the wall to get him and returns to the ship. Somehow no one in DC has seen a huge golden robot, but, you know. Gort places Klaatu's body on a table, and we see some kind of light happen, and then we cut. So now we get to the penultimate moment in this original. Barnhart has gathered all the scientists outside of the ship right there on the field. And he's been given permission for the meeting, is now told by the government that he's got to clear out because Gort has disappeared and it's possibly not safe. And just as that happens, Klaatu is revived, apparently undamaged, although he says he's on borrowed time and he doesn't know how long he has to live. So now Gort emerges from the ship before all the assembled scientists, and then Klaatu and Helen. And Klaatu's back in his jumpsuit, and he gives his final speech, which is basically that the intergalactic community has entrusted the safety of the galaxy to robots like Gort and basically given them the ultimate power of enforcement. And at the first sign of any aggression by any planetary civilization, the planet's wiped out automatically. And it's exactly, you know, kind of like what was going on in the 50s, what they called MAD, mutually assured destruction. And there were kind of talks that, like, that possibly, you know, both sides had built doomsday devices and put these doomsday devices in automatic mode where the countries themselves that created the doomsday devices couldn't even get to them. I don't think this ever happened, but it's kind of the same idea where a country might say to another country, it was often theorized at that point that maybe the Russians would say or the Americans would say, here's all the plans and schematics of this doomsday's device we created. Once we turned it on, we no longer have control over it. And if anybody launches a nuclear missile on the planet, it'll automatically fire all of our nuclear missiles at that power and annihilate them. So this is the sci-fi version of it, which is great. Basically, Klaatu says that he offers Earth to join his confederation and live in peace or be destroyed. And with that, him and Gort take off, and the movie ends, which is amazing. So I'm gonna get to how cool that is when I finish the remake. We join the remake where Helen, Klaatu, and Jacob are in the woods again on the run. Jacob, being even more of an annoying little boy, splits off and waves to the helicopters, giving them away. Then we have this supposedly penultimate moment of character between Helen and Jacob. You know, Jacob is like, if Dad were here, he'd do all this stuff. And so Helen finally grows a pair and says, you know, he's not here, he's dead, he's gone. And of course he cries, you know, and it's just, it's really ridiculous. Then this ziplining spec ops guy kind of comes down like Batman and grabs her and pulls her back up into a helicopter. And so she's gone, leaving Klaatu and Jacob on the ground together for the first time. So then he defeats them by the same way Gort just did. They train their weapons on him of laser guidance, and he feeds back through the laser guidance system and overloads all their weapons and takes two of the helicopters down. And turning his back on the helicopters when they crash, which is like a scene from Con Air. You know, it's kind of cheesy, like bad guys don't look at explosions, right? So Jacob now runs from Klaatu. He's afraid. Klaatu saves him from falling into a river. I mean, it's a really bad. The kid playing Jacob is just so bad. Now we cut to Gort and a technician. This is the Gort's change, his big transformation. So a technician has broken one of his diamond drills and he's putting a new drill bit into place. And we zoom in microscopically to see the old bit. Some nanites are on the surface, seemingly dividing and multiplying at this incredibly fast rate. They begin to use the actual technician who's been sent in there to do it. We see this kind of rash breaking out over his face and on his coat, and we realize that the nanites are starting to eat him. And of course, the bad guy military dude won't let him out. He starts drilling again. Finally, we start to see these kind of spider cracks on the glass separating them from Gort. And really, Gort is now completely transforming into a swarm of nanites, which erodes now the glass and completely annihilates all the men in the bunker. They hit this sterilization button, which, you know, floods the what looks like an old missile tube with, you know, plasma or flame. Does absolutely nothing. And the swarm of nanites now makes its way out of the facility and sort of, you know, bound for we know not where. So now we get some CGI. We see the effects of these nanites. It picks up a truck off the highway and completely disintegrates it as it moves on. And none of it looks very real. The CGI is really, really apparent here. So you're really in kind of a fantasy movie at this point. Helen is released from custody. Michael comes along with her, and they're all headed now towards Central Park for whatever reason. There's some communication between Helen and Jacob. I think Jacob and Klaatu end up at this small shack out of nowhere. Jacob calls Helen, and they arrange this meet at Jacob's father's grave, right? So we have a little bit of a grave site, but here's moved to the end. So here we're at the cemetery, and this is supposed to be the moment where Klaatu has his, you know, in the original, Klaatu didn't change his mind about humanity. He's like, it's up to you, but this is what's going to happen. And in this one, Jacob like begs Klaatu, please revive my dad, please bring him back to life, you know, which he did with the cop just recently. And Klaatu refuses. He says, it doesn't work like that. And then Helen arrives, and it's this shapeless, non-dramatic sequence where Jacob's crying at his father's grave, you know, I guess finally accepting that he's dead. And Klaatu's observing it all. And we're meant to believe in the movie that he's now seeing another side of humanity that he feels, or he feels part of it because he's human in some ways. And we in the audience, we don't see a damn thing. We don't see any change. There's nothing that happens in this moment that's going to make me believe that humanity is going to be able to change their ways and save the planet. And yet, Klaatu is convinced. Human beings have been grieving for their loved ones since the dawn of time. We've been crying over dead people for hundreds of thousands of years, and, you know, the planet's still a mess. So what the hell is Klaatu's like, I see something in you now, which is just a complete stinking pile of BS. It's lazy writing, and it doesn't mean anything. We haven't seen a thing. So now we have our basic, you know, sci-fi action movie endpoint, you know, where they get these orders to, I guess it's a nuke order to do something, you know, a larger strike is going to be perpetrated against the ship. New York City is empty. you know, where we're in this tension-filled safe chase where Klaatu, I think Michael and Jacob and Helen are in this car, you know, because Klaatu says, he now wants to save the planet from the swarm, so he says, I have to get to my ship. Just as they get close to his ship, the airstrike comes and, of course, does no damage, but the car gets flipped over, Michael dies. You know, there's some nice shots of the swarm entering Manhattan from the air. Michael's dead. The effects of the swarm are beginning. It's like M. Night Shyamalan's happening, you know, the race against the nature, right, or the swarm. So they duck under this bridge, which somehow the nanites, you know, they're everywhere, but they won't go under a land bridge in Central Park. You know, they must think it's pretty bad under there. Jacob faints. You know, the nanites are inside him, killing him. They're in her, too. So Klaatu saves them both and draws the nanites out of them. He takes them into himself, and then he walks out into the nanite cloud, supposedly not affected by it. They're not going to kill him. There's no tension at all. And he finally gets to the sphere, and the minute he touches it, the cloud dies. But there's some effect that happens around the entire planet where we get these sort of, you know, as it were, a global EMP is triggered, which is how this movie ends, that the price, he tells them earlier, like, that he could save the planet, but it would come with a price. So he triggers a global EMP that takes down all of our technology and pretty much brings us back to the Stone Age, you know, Middle Ages. And technological civilization ends, and the movie ends. The Endgame comparisons here really show the two different films. The original film, Klaatu is never convinced that humanity has a chance because we don't go there. You know, basically, we see Helen's boyfriend turn into kind of a real schmo, and we see that side of humanity. We see the promise that is in Bobby. We see the promise that is in Helen. And yet, even so, Klaatu's not, none of that's convincing. You know, people like that. Tom and Helen and Bobby have lived for a long time. They've been, you know, billions of human beings like them and like Tom. World is still in the same place, right? So he basically says, listen, you know, we've created a doomsday device. It's up to you. If you come out guns blazing, your civilization's over. Take it easy. And he leaves, you know, which is incredibly powerful. And you walk out of the film thinking to yourself, there's a question implicit in the ending that you take away with you, that you know, go to dinner afterwards and you're like, so what do you think? What do you think we would do if that happened? Do we have it in us to stop and to not be aggressors and to actually become a peaceful civilization? To me, that's a meaty question and a meaty discussion that a movie would generate. The remake shows you nothing. The relationships are nothing. They do absolutely nothing. Jacob's relationship and his arc, and Helen's as well. Who cares about any of it, really? And Klaatu, you know, convinced for some bizarre reason that none of us can figure out. And basically, at the end of the day, you know, he leaves, and what is the world going to think? That aliens attacked us, they wiped out our civilization. So they're basically going to, you know, we're going to rebuild, saying, like, well, we've got to be even more aggressive. We got to protect against these aliens who are going to come back, you know, at a certain point in time and maybe do it again. It's almost like we're poised to be even more aggressive and more militant and industrial. And I don't know. It's just, it makes no sense. The movie has no theme. It has nothing on its mind except that, you know, Klaatu removed civilization. Almost, it's the opposite of the original, where the original was like, you're adults, you'll figure it out. If you make the wrong choice, you're dead. And Klaatu is basically like, your children, so I'm going to send you back to the playpen, and maybe this time you'll be better, which is just, for me, very not interesting. Just a brief to sum up, I've been blathering on for way over an hour now, but the original is a very curious film. It's not much of a monster movie, even though it has some of the, you know, monster movie-ish trappings, like, you know, we see the poster and some of Gort and how he's filmed, some of the music. And even the sci-fi elements are very limited in terms of effects. The two protagonists are human beings. The drama doesn't really stick at the end of the day. You know, Bobby kind of drops out near the end of the film. You know, he's not much of a force that's dramatically unified for the whole thing. So it's kind of weird. He's kind of forgotten in the end. Helen isn't much of a character either, although she's kind of an archetype of, you know, what a non-violent, trusting, good human would be. And at the end, when he waves goodbye and goes into his ship, there's not too much of a dramatic tug there for me, because it wasn't, relationship wasn't much, even though she believed him. And Wise's reliance on montage, to me, saps the film of kind of dramatic glue, because we're always going like 1,000 feet up and seeing the worldwide situation, and it leaves a little bit less time for us to stay with the characters, which I think You know, the remake tried to rectify that in some way, but it just had nothing on its mind. It's cool seeing the global impact, but when the human drama happens, it's very brief, and it doesn't really stick with me. But the script is incredibly intelligent, and it never panders to the audience. It's never dumb, ever, you know? And it ends on a very intelligent, very ambiguous note, and doesn't dare wade into places of saying, things are going to go one way or another. Versus the remake, the environmental flip was a really clever idea, but there's nothing else that really reinforces this. There's nothing in the movie that's showing us, like, how did we get here? What is it about our nature that makes us destroy the planet? And I think you could have done this easily, especially the character of the old man, which I think was a great idea. Who is this alien that's lived among us and now wants to die among us? Like, to me, that's such ripe for story. It's so ripe for story that, you know, maybe a lot of the film could have been kind of a road movie between these two characters, the old man showing the new arrival about the planet and why it's beautiful, but at the same time, why it's horrible. Like, I would have been totally on board with that. But they do nothing with it. That's one scene between the two of them and it's done. And we're spending most of our human drama time with two non-characters, very dull, boring characters, Helen and Jacob, who are nothing. There's really nothing there. There's no point to them. The end of the film is very pandering, like, you know, we need to be sent back to pre-industrial times, otherwise the planet's going to die. Like, that makes absolutely no sense. So I feel like the remake is very much, you know, they try to do all this action movie stuff. It really is very similar to the movie The Invasion, which was like the third try at Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Very similar. Like, it didn't know what it wanted to say, and it just wound up being kind of like an action adventure sci-fi thriller, and the stuff it kind of wanted to say got buried in the thriller aspects of it, which kind of happens here, you know. So and the effects are in the remake, which should have been amazing, are just not. So whatever happened there, who knows. But and I'll briefly talk about the cast, the comparisons of the cast. So we have Michael Rennie versus Keanu. So Michael Rennie is projects an extremely intelligent persona. So this man is very intelligent. He's very urbane, you know, extremely, his diction is very clipped. You know, he's extremely smart. He has a great, great body in terms of how he moves and how he sets himself. Like, he's very charismatic. I like him a lot. I like his eyes. I like the intelligence that's coming out of him. Whereas Keanu rarely can project intelligence. And I don't mean that as a knock. That's not his bag. That's not his thing as an actor. He doesn't project that. He's more enigmatic. He's much more sinister and enigmatic than Michael Rennie is. So in this film, I think because they're jumping everything up to push the drama a little more, that they want Klaatu to be a little more sinister. So it kind of serves that Keanu is there to be a little more like, and we see Klaatu doing some serious shit in the remake, in terms of incapacitating people and all this power that he has. If you're not someone who's seen the original, you're thinking, man, it's possible that this character is a bad guy. He really has some serious power. Whereas in the original film, Klaatu never, there's never a sinister moment. It's Gort that's really the sinister one. But Klaatu very much is very urbane and gentlemanly like, and you never get a sense of sinisterness coming from him. You just don't know what he's there for, which again, to my own sensibilities, is more interesting. And in 2008, to have Klaatu be a little more sinister, like, okay, you know, I kind of know what they're going for, but it's just less interesting to me. Jennifer Connelly versus Patricia Neal. I think, unfortunately, Patricia Neal has more meat to her character. There's more for her to do. She has this interaction with her boyfriend, Tom. And because of that, she has more rich problems and more down-to-earth problems to deal with. Whereas Helen Benson in the remake, you know, she's just pretty much chiding her son and driving Keanu around the whole movie. There's not really much for her to do. And as such, there's really nothing there. I think, again, Jennifer Connelly is a terrific actress, but I think Helen Benson in the original film is just a more interesting character. The kids, comparing the kids, Jaden Smith is a really bad actor. I'll just say this right now. And he's really bad in this film. The kid in the original film is not the best actor either. He's more of a he's like, gee whiz, Ma, I saw this and I went there. So he's not the greatest actor either. For whatever reason, there's something about the kids acting in the original that's more in line with kind of gee whiz acting styles of the time. So I don't mind it as much because I think I'm allowing the original a bit of a historical anachronism. You know, I have a little lens there. But in this day and age, like, Jaden Smith, oh, he's bad. So I personally don't like his performance in any way. To his credit, he's given really very little to work with. He's just kind of a cranky kid who misses his dad. He doesn't do much of anything except rat out Keanu and be angry the whole movie. There's really nothing to him at all. Obviously, I talked about the two different aides to the president. I think Kathy Bates' aide, the character, and the actress, both just very wanting. And I think the characters are very one-note and very boring. Obviously, at the end, she does allow Helen Benson access, but you know she allows it knowing that the planes are coming in to blow the thing up. So there's not really much to her. She's just kind of a barking head. Whereas Harley is very interesting. And, you know, we don't get him the whole movie, but he's just a very interesting character that's rarely do I see, you know, an understanding government aide who's wise to the drawbacks of his own species, you know, and his own administration, as it were. So I really like that. The Gort comparisons, you know, the thing is the original Gort is a goofy guy in a dumb robot suit. Like, come on, I can't really defend Gort in any way in the original. However, the remake, there's definitely more menace, the remake, the Gort, as it's rendered in CGI, it's terrible looking, but it is very menacing. So there's something, and of course the size of it is so imposing that I think that might have more to do with it, and it's just so bloody large that it has a natural menace to it. And the original is just like, you know, it's goofy, but it's not overplayed. So it's not like it's walking around doing so much in the movie. Most of the movie, it's simply but you know, inert, standing there, which allows for whatever menace or mystery that it could generate on its own. Let's face it, there's not much on either way. The ships, there's no real comparison. The initial ship is your basic flying saucer from the 50s, and the sort of liquid marbles of the remake are beautiful, beautiful design. They just are beautiful, and they do different things, and, you know, the smaller ones are arcs, and all the incredible shifting colors of them. They're just really well rendered, and they're bright, and they throw shadows out. So got to give it to the remake for the design of the ships, big time. So that's my comparison of the original versus remake of Day the Earth Stood Still. I will see you next time.